Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 22nd of April. 3 years ago, the state of Massachusetts put together the what has been described boldest state healthcare experiment in American history. They have brought near universal coverage to the Commonwealth. They achieved high coverage by mandating that almost every resident have health insurance and that all but the smallest businesses make some contribution toward their employees' cost. If you don't enroll but you are deemed able to afford insurance, you can be fined up to $1,068 in the 2009 tax year. Why is it that Massachusetts decided to do this kind of healthcare reform? What are the successes? What are the problems that they have encountered in the past 3 years? We have two guests with us this hour to talk about Massachusetts and healthcare reform and ask the question, is this a model for the country as we explore healthcare reform on a national basis? We have two guests with us this hour. Half hour will be the dividing between the two guests. John Kingsdale is Executive Director of the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority, which is an independent authority established under Massachusetts health reform legislation of 2006 to promote coverage of the uninsured. He was a senior executive at the Tufts Health Plans for almost 20 years, responsible for strategic planning, product development, public affairs, and government relations, and has taught at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Boston University School of Public Health. We're going to be welcoming phone calls on this topic. We get flooded with phone calls whenever we discuss healthcare. So may I give you the number and the email address and feel free to call us as early as you'd like. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, do that at talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org. John Kingsdale, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
My pleasure.
All eyes are on Massachusetts these days, right?
Well, there's a lot of eyes on Washington, D.C. as well.
Exactly. Some of those Washington eyes are looking at you. Tell me why Massachusetts decided to really address this health care problem 3 years ago. What was the impetus for it?
You know, there may be something in the water here. I say that facetiously, but we actually tried to do universal health coverage and passed a lot of that effect back in 1988. And it's a, you know, obviously a moral issue of great concern across the country and one that Massachusetts has long been focused on and had done a number of reforms leading up to what we call Chapter 58 that was enacted in 2006 to get us to near universal coverage.
You were quoted recently in the New York Times saying, just as this may have been the easiest place to do coverage, it may be the most difficult place to do cost control.
Well, I don't think that's what I was trying to say. What I do believe is that it is very difficult anywhere in the United States to do universal coverage, to do significant expansion of access. And it is nearly impossible. Not impossible, but nearly impossible to do real cost control. We decided, you know, to be quite blunt, to tackle the first problem first. And I think from the moral high ground of having covered virtually everyone, we're now going to tackle what is even a more difficult challenge, which is cost containment.
Mm-hmm. It does seem as though everybody would agree that people should have health insurance coverage, and yet this ethical decision is something that hasn't been at the forefront as the number of people in this country who are uninsured keeps climbing. It's a huge number of people.
It is. It's over 15% when last measured.
Oh my.
And that's from 2007. I would expect, given the recession, that we're probably over 50 million as we speak nationally uninsured in April 2009.
So tell me about the plan in Massachusetts. How did you cover everyone?
Well, it's nearly everyone, first of all. There's still probably 2.5-3% of the population that's not covered, which gives us by far the lowest uninsured rate, but it's we still got a little bit to go. And we did it, I would say, under the framework of shared responsibility. Mm. And that's really been a campaign theme here leading up to and in the 2.5 years since the law was passed and we've been implementing it. And the sort of the cornerstones of that concept are, first of all, that individuals, if they can afford it, have to buy insurance, and that particularly applies to folks, the so-called young invincibles, who can think of lots of other things to do with their money than buy protection from an event that they think is unlikely to happen to them, you know, serious illness or injury. It means requiring employers to make a fair and reasonable contribution towards coverage for their employees, and, of course, government taxpayers to step in and help those of low income who cannot afford to buy on their own to do so.
And was it difficult in the state to accomplish this? Did you almost have to have a Republican governor and a Democratic Congress to pass this?
You know, it's interesting. I haven't really thought about it in that way, but there is a certain logic, kind of the same logic as, you know, Nixon goes to China
right.
Back in the 1970s. It takes some portion willingness and initiative from the right-hand side of the political spectrum to make this more of a consensus. And it was, in fact, a virtually universal, unanimous vote. I mean, in a legislature of 40 senators and 160 representatives, all but two representatives voted for this. And there's been tremendous support ever since for implementing it. So, you know, that bipartisan nature, I don't know that that's nationally possible, but it's certainly been a real plus here in Massachusetts. And frankly, for those of us who, you know, I had very little to do with conceptualizing or getting this thing passed, but for people like me, and there's dozens and dozens of them in the state with major responsibilities to implement, it's just a fantastic luxury to have that level of broad support.
Oh, I would imagine. And what makes you say that you don't know if it would be nationally possible?
Well, the country seems a little less, politically more diverse, geographically, in terms of income and coverage levels, much more diverse. It's just a tougher climb. For example, California tried to do something fairly similar to what we did, and that, of course, is just one other state. It's a large state. But there, the number of uninsured is literally 10 to 12 times the size of our uninsured population in Massachusetts, above 20% of their population. And the average income level, median income, is much lower in California than Massachusetts. So there are a lot of challenges, both politically and in terms of the breadth of the problem. It's just a bigger climb nationally.
I see. Did you have a problem with small businesses and businesses not contributing to health care coverage?
Well, there again, we had reasonably good coverage from offered by employers and many employers already offering. And we actually had, again, unlike, frankly, the 1988 reform, which business opposed, we were able, under this rubric of shared responsibility, to bring employers in under the tent supporting enactment, and they've been very, very supportive of implementation ever since. So, you know, that's been a wonderful story. And, in fact, a study was just released here for the first year of reform, 2007, showing that everybody, individuals, government, and employers, have stepped to the line to increase their financial responsibilities for covering more people.
What we hear from so many businesses is the cost of providing this as a benefit to employees has become just out of their financial reach. How have you been able, how have small businesses and larger businesses been able to deal with increasing costs of health care?
Well, that's the number one challenge, and it's they've been able, fortunately, to do it in a fairly robust economy. Now that we're facing recession, at least, I think the pressure to deal with the annual escalation in costs is really mounting, and now I think most people here, businesses, employers, and folks in government, and even those who, if you will, take money out of the healthcare system, doctors, hospitals, health insurance companies, for providing healthcare services, are all recognized that, you know, the days of double-digit increases, inflation in health insurance premiums and healthcare costs, in the midst of a recession is absolutely unsustainable. And so I'm hoping that we now have the momentum in order to maintain access and coverage to actually deal with cost containment. But that is a challenge.
I'm sure it is. I understand that the state also subsidizes premiums for those who earn up to three times the federal poverty level, or $66,150 for a family of four. Is that difficult for the state to do? Where does that money come from?
Yes, and again, in these, you know, the financial crunch with tax revenues falling, that is a challenge. I have to say that it's a remarkable testimony to the level of support for this moral commitment that so far in the budget documents that have been developed both by the administration and in the House of Representatives in Massachusetts looking to the next fiscal year beginning July 1, they are fully funding coverage for health reform, including that level of subsidy.
We're going to go to phone calls. We have a lot of people who would already like to speak with you. We thought as we continue to talk about health care reform, and we have for years and years and years, why not look at Massachusetts? 3 years ago, they enacted what was then called a bold and the boldest in the country state health care experiment in American history. It's been going on for 3 years now, and there was pretty widespread agreement that this was a moral issue, an ethical issue that this state had to deal with. And we're talking about the successes and the fiscal problems they may face now as we're in a recession or maybe worse than that. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. John Kingsdale is Executive Director of the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority. And we start our calls with Dana from Madison. Hi, Dana.
Hey, I'm kind of a young guy, so I might not know like all the details regarding this specific law that was passed in Massachusetts, but I don't know, from just what I heard, I kind of disagree with what they're doing. I mean, it just seems like, I mean, I know that they're only making people get insurance for people that can afford it, but it still seems like they're just kind of like forcing people to pay money for something, you know, that they might not necessarily. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people do need health insurance and whatnot, but
do you have?
I don't know, it just seems like they're forcing them to pay for something.
Do you have health insurance, Dana?
I do not have any insurance.
And does that bother you at all?
It does, because when I do want to go to the hospital, it seems like, I don't know, like, you know, I always think about how much it's going to cost as opposed to what the consequences are if I don't go to the hospital. And luckily, I haven't had anything too severe happen to me yet, but I don't know. It's just, I mean, I think people should be able to make the decision whether or not they want to have health insurance and, you
know. Okay. Let's get a response from John. John?
Well, I understand what Dana's saying. In fact, I can remember back in my 20s, health insurance was probably not number one on my priority list. And I'm kind of assuming that he's what we would refer to as a so-called young invincible, somebody who thinks they're likely not, as many of the uninsured think, likely not to need services. But if Dana were to step off the curb, God forbid, and get hit by a bus, he, his parents, society would expect that he'd be picked up by an ambulance and taken to an emergency room and, if necessary, treated in the ICU, all of which could run to tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, some people who don't have insurance don't, that happens to, and their costs actually get added on to the costs of folks who do buy insurance, making it even more expensive for them. So this is a way of saying, frankly, and I know it's a harsh message, Dana, if you expect that level of care, you do need to contribute something on an ongoing basis to financing it, because we're all just a diagnosis or an accident away from some very, very expensive stuff. Now, in order to help younger people afford insurance, we actually have provided some sort of, if you will, cut-rate young adult plans that are cover a little less and are a lot less expensive. But it's, nevertheless, we're asking folks of all, adults of all ages, to make a contribution.
And if on cue, although we didn't plan it that way, there was an ambulance going past you as you were answering that question. That was strange. Thank you very much, Dana, for your call. Rodney from Milwaukee. Hi, Rodney.
Hi. I've been dealing with the health care insurance, or I have sickle cell, all my life in insurance. And what I found out about the whole thing, I agree with that we all should have the shared responsibility. But one thing I don't agree with the whole business of it is insurance. I think paying a middleman, we all should pool our money together for a pool of medical, but not to the insurance companies. And I'll give you an example of why this is never going to work nationally or will never have insurance. It's because when I go to pick up my medicine or go to the doctor, the insurance company doesn't want to pay for a pill that will help me stay out of the hospital. But if I have to go in the hospital because I don't have this pill, they pay for that. It's basically they're trying to make a profit. They don't want to pay for things. The hospital wants to make money. They want to give me necessary tests. And so they're fighting against each other. So there's no way that healthcare will ever be solved if we have a middleman cutting 15% off all profits or making big profits off of healthcare. And so it's good for the insurance companies that everybody buys insurance, but it's not good for the patients. I think we should just, like we say, all of us pool our money together, have community hospitals again, or something that doesn't include the insurance company.
Thanks, Rodney, for the call. John?
Yeah, I understand what Rodney's saying, which is the insurance companies, I think there's two things he's saying. One is that the administrative costs of financing health care and so forth can be wasteful and excessive, and I actually agree with him there. And one of the things that we're going to do, I think, if we're going to get costs under control, is find some more efficient ways to distribute health insurance and to make it work. And one of the things that we do here, we run something called a connector or an exchange, and there's a lot of interest in that nationally as a more efficient way to buy insurance, make it easier for people to make choices at lower sort of costs. The other element, though, he pointed to was not covering drugs, for example. And again, it's been very controversial here. A lot of people didn't want us to require that folks have insurance that actually does cover drugs, and we made that determination precisely because of the points Rodney made about the importance. I mean, that's a major therapeutic option. Insurance needs to cover drugs as much as it needs to cover surgery. And there is some natural tension between the folks like insurers paying the bills and the folks like providers billing them. But, you know, frankly, most universal coverage countries in Europe, for example, have private insurance companies. Many do not. Many have just a single state plan, but many have insurance companies, and they make it work, and they spend a whole lot less than we do. So I think it's how you set it up as opposed to there's just one right way. That's the key here.
Thanks, Rodney, so much for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation as we look at what kinds of changes we want to make nationally to our health care system. How do we address the large numbers of people who are uninsured? How do we address the rising cost of health care in this country? We look at the state of Massachusetts, which may be a model for the country. John Kingsdale, our guest for a few more minutes, executive director of the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority, and our phone number, 800-486-8655. We discuss this all hour, so just keep those calls coming. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're looking at Massachusetts healthcare reform this hour of the program. I hope I have this quote right, but this is interesting. Where it is that we can go in the healthcare system, and you have said that it's difficult, that we've got challenges here in limiting resources for people who are doing really good stuff. It's not like the fat sits out here easily identified and you just slice it off. It is marbled throughout the meat. That's an interesting statement. John.
Yes. I'm sorry. You cut out for a minute.
I heard the statement.
Did you want me to elaborate on that? I missed your question.
Sure. Would you? Yeah. Elaborate.
Well, you know, I actually I'm an old man. I've been in this field for 30 plus years and got interested in it originally in the 1970s in Washington, D.C., when, frankly, folks were running around a little bit like chickens with their heads cut off, saying, you know, the cost of Medicare and Medicaid is going through the roof, and, oh, my God, we're spending 8% of our gross domestic product on health care, and that's not sustainable. Of course, now we're spending 16% was the last measure, and probably in 2009 it's going to be closer to 18% of our gross domestic product on health insurance and health care. I guess I made a professional career out of failing to control health care costs, to be a little self-deprecating about it. But it is difficult for a number of reasons. One is that this is, frankly, really good stuff to spend money on.
Sure.
You know, the marvels, and I think there's too little, frankly, celebration of the marvels of modern medicine and what we are able to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have two hip replacements, and my grandfather was chair-bound when he had arthritis of his hips 30, 40 years ago. I experienced, and most of us experienced it firsthand. On the other hand, that makes it really difficult because so much of what we do, what is done in medicine, is not evidence-based. It doesn't have necessarily a scientific a documentation or proof that this will work and that won't. There's some art to it. There's a lot of, frankly, habit to it. That's why it might cost twice as much for end-of-life care here in Boston or out in L.A. as it does in Minnesota. Near you at the Mayo Clinic, for example, which is Medicare data shows us. So we know there's some major variances in the way folks practice medicine and what we do to people to try to help them that are not of proven value. But we're not sure exactly which ones are where the waste is and where it's not. And that's what that comment was about.
John, when you spoke of end-of-life costs, have you done anything to control the end-of-life costs? Do you think that we'll have to at some point?
Well, in Massachusetts, it's an area of interest. It's also, of course, one that's fraught with moral hazard and
sure.
Difficulties. And so I would not advocate, dealing with end-of-life care issues from the point of view of saving money, rather from the point of view of giving patients and our seniors the best options for them. You know, in Oregon, for example, about 30% of people who die late in life die in a hospital, and about 70% die outside of the hospital. Here in Massachusetts, the ratio is almost reversed, where the vast majority die in a hospital. And in a hospital, people are trained and oriented to apply as much technology as they think not inappropriate to try to save and prolong life. That's not necessarily, frankly, what most people in Oregon choose. I mean, in Oregon, there's very wide distribution of sort of patient orders for end-of-life care. And I think there's not enough of an effort made here and in many parts of the country to make sure that seniors do express where they want to die, if it gets to that, what they want done to them to prolong
right.
life. And it's really for their benefit and an ancillary outcome, if we can do that in Massachusetts, and there are some efforts being made to do it, will be probably a reduction in the intensity of medical services applied at the end of life.
It's still a tricky thing. We just don't want to die, do we? We have a hard time with that issue, I think, in this country.
You know, there's a saying that the English consider death inevitable, the Canadians think it's postponable, and Americans think it's elective.
I'll use that line again. That was a good one. Do you have time for one more phone call? I know you're busy.
Sure.
We'll go to John from Eau Claire, and then we'll change guests here and continue on the topic. Hi, John.
Hi. I was just curious on what was the additional cost that the federal government helped them out with to keep that plan in motion?
Great question. I'm going to jump right in because I do have to go. And federal support is absolutely essential, I think, for any of the states to make major, major inroads here. In our case, most of our expenses are matchable under a Medicaid waiver, meaning that in Massachusetts gets about 50% of the cost to state government, paid for by federal contributions under our Medicaid contract.
Thank you very much for the call. John, thanks so much for being with us. It was really most informative. Thank you.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
John Kingsdale, our first guest, executive director of the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority. That he has been working to promote coverage of the uninsured and has a long history in the field of health care at Harvard School of Public Health and at Tufts and various other places. We're going to continue our conversation. John Gruber is joining us now. He's a professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, also director of the Program on Children at the National Bureau of Economic Research. In the year 2006, he was appointed to the board of the Massachusetts Insurance Connector. And his research focuses on the areas of public finance and health economics. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him, as we did for the earlier guest. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that's up and running now. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. This hour, we're talking about Massachusetts. 3 years ago, they enacted health care reform because they morally believe that everybody should have health insurance. And as you heard John say, they are now at the point where only 2.5 to 3% of people in the state of Massachusetts do not have health insurance. They are facing some problems with cost as a result of what he called the recession, if not, he didn't use the word, but depression. So it's creating some financial problems, as it is for everybody. John Gruber is joining us now. Stay on the line. We'll be with your phone calls in a moment. Good morning, John. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Give me an assessment of the strengths and the weaknesses of the Massachusetts reform enacted 3 years ago. What's working really well? What needs tweaking?
I think what's working really well is what the reform was designed to do, which was to cover the citizens of Massachusetts. We've got our uninsurance rate down to about 2.7%, which is by far the lowest in the nation. We've got very high public satisfaction with how we've done it. We basically managed to succeed in covering the people who needed coverage without disrupting those who are happy with what they have. So I think for what the law is designed to do, it's done really well. I think that basically the problem is that basically the law was not designed to control costs. So while I think the law has done all it can to help keep the costs under control, ultimately that is something which is going to require a separate effort.
And what needs to be done, do you think, to control costs?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I mean, I think to fundamentally control costs, I'm not sure any one state can do it. I think that may need to be the federal government may need to take the lead on that. I'm not sure that any one state can really do what's necessary to control costs in this country. But in terms of what the state can do, we've made some strides in that direction by setting up a commission to look at our payment of providers and rationalizing that. You know, I know you just had John Kingsdale on. John Kingsdale has one of my favorite anecdotes. I'm sorry if I'm repeating one he already used. But he talks about the woman on the North Shore of Boston who's having a baby, who will drive by the North Shore Medical Center, where there's a doctor with 30 years' experience delivering babies, to drive to downtown Boston to pay three times as much to have a 25-year-old deliver her baby.
Oh, my.
And we need to rationalize the payment system so that's not happening anymore.
Right. I'm wondering, we've heard that there's a huge expense of people who don't have insurance going to the emergency room when they have some kind of medical problem, clogging the system, resulting in huge increase in cost because that's where you're going for your delivery of care. Have you noticed a savings because people have insurance and they're not going to the hospitals?
There's definitely been a decline in emergency room use. There's been a real savings in that emergency. In particular, we had something in our state called the uncompensated care pool, where we paid for uninsured people who went to the hospital and used the emergency room when they should have been going to doctors. That's fallen about in half, and our goal is to ultimately have that fall by about two-thirds as part of the law. So I think we're definitely showing some showing signs of improvement there.
What about how you've changed the system, if indeed you have, to deal with the issue of prevention, illness prevention, and control of chronic disease?
You know, in some sense, once again, that was not really the goal of this law. This law was, in some sense, successful because it wasn't overly ambitious. I think if you look at the history of the United States, this comes to sort of where we are in national reform. Every about 17 years, we've tried to reform health care, and every time we've tried, it's fallen under the weight of its own criteria. I think that what Massachusetts did is said, look, we know how to do one thing well. Let's get people covered. That will help with wellness and prevention because people have insurance. They'll get to the doctor rather than waiting until they're sick. But we're not going to fundamentally transform the way medical care is delivered. If we try to do that, the bill will never get passed. And I think that was a great model for the nation. Let's deal with the problem we know how to deal with, which is getting people insurance coverage.
John Kingsdale said in the first half hour that he didn't know if the Massachusetts model was nationally possible just because there's a variety of opinion and much more dissension about where we need to go with health care in this country. Would you agree with that or not?
I would disagree in some sense, agree in other sense. I think it's absolutely possible technically, and I think there's a way to do it that would make everybody happy, with one hitch, which is paying for it, which is sort of like saying, you know, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? I think we can do the Massachusetts-style plan nationally in a way which will please both liberals and conservatives, but I think that doing so is going to come with a hefty price tag, maybe about $150 billion a year, and that is the issue, is going to be raising the money to pay for it.
Here's an email, and then we'll go to phone calls for you. It seems that pre-existing condition is a gray area, and so many have a pre-existing condition that it excludes the majority of people who would be excluded from individual health insurance if they had to get it on their own.
Pre-existing conditions are not a problem in Massachusetts because we now have that anyone can get into our connector and get health insurance coverage that does not exclude pre-existing conditions at group rates. So that's not really an issue in Massachusetts.
And that makes a lot of sense. That should certainly be a national priority.
Absolutely. I think basically the logic of healthcare reform really runs as follows. We've got to make health insurance markets work in a way where they don't discriminate against the sick. The whole idea of insurance is to protect the sick, not to discriminate against them. And the way we get insurance markets to work so they don't discriminate against the sick is to get everyone insured, to get everyone in those insurance pools so that healthy and sick alike are buying insurance and it's not just the sick buying and trying to buy at extraordinary prices.
Yes. Let's go to phone calls. Brian from Green Bay. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. So important. I have 2 points. One is a Green Bay native, my son. He'd wanted to school, so he looked and he found Boston. As a matter of fact, he's in Alston right across the bridge from you. And he learned that the health care benefits there were an important factor in his decision, as well as Boston being the new Athens of our culture. The question is, how can Wisconsin do the same? And the next point is that we do have an opportunity to reduce cost, and that's through chiropractic care. Chiropractors provide preventive care that's much more effective and less expensive and far safer than conventional medical care. How can we integrate chiropractic into this formula?
Well, those are two good questions. I appreciate the kind words about Boston, but those are two very good questions. In terms of what you can do in Wisconsin, I think there's no reason a Massachusetts-style approach can't work in Wisconsin. You have a number of the advantages Massachusetts had in the sense that you have a relatively or lower than average number of uninsured. You have a progressive state history and culture that would permit this to happen politically. On the other hand, I've been working some in the state of Wisconsin, and the difficulty you face is you have relatively unregulated insurance markets. We had fairly highly regulated insurance markets, so it wasn't as big a step for us to reform them. You have a pretty wide open and unregulated insurance market. So I think the first step is realizing that regulating insurance markets is going to mean that the healthy are going to pay more while the sick pay less. And that's going to be a battle you're going to have to take on. In terms of chiropractic care, I think, you know, I don't want to touch on that specifically because I think we get 100 different calls with 100 different opinions on that issue. I think the bigger issue is what exactly should we force people to buy and what should we not force them to buy? I think very strongly chiropractic care is the kind of thing we should not force them to buy. We should do is force people to get a minimal package of insurance that protects them against financial catastrophe and provides preventive care, and then leave people the choice of what works for them.
Thanks, Brian, very much for the call. More phone calls in a moment. We're looking at Massachusetts healthcare reform, which has been existing for 3 years now. How is it working? Should we look at it as we look at healthcare reform in America? I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of the question of the program, the question is, what are you reading now? Nancy Pearl, our wonderful librarian, will be here. She doesn't just look at the bestsellers. She looks at books that she's reread. I never do that. I love the fact that she rereads books, and she reads so much, and she is just a top-notch reader, so she can recommend books to you, and I'm interested in knowing what you're reading as well. So that's coming up the second hour of our program. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor John Gruber is with us this hour, professor of economics at MIT, and he was appointed 3 years ago to the board of the Massachusetts Insurance Connector. His research focuses on public finance and health economics. And we go next to Bill from Wild Rose. Hello, Bill.
Good morning. A great show, as usual. The question that I have is, what is being done or being proposed for people who choose healthy lifestyles as opposed to those who do not? And one in specific is, this country is on a fast train to obesity, which causes all kinds of health problems and health costs. And a lot of these are just simply changing your lifestyle. Are there incentives built in, or can there be incentives built in? And can there be something built in that penalizes people that don't wear helmets on motorcycles, things of that sort?
Bill, that's a great question. In fact, part of this law was for the first time it allowed insurers to discriminate to charge different prices to smokers versus non-smokers for that exact reason. Obesity is a lot trickier, and that's a generally hard public policy issue. And I think that we need to look very seriously into policies which reward people for responsible lifestyles and penalize them for irresponsible ones. And that's not something we're doing yet in Massachusetts. But I think there's a lot of people interested in that. I think that's something we'll see coming down the road very soon.
Thanks, Bill, for your call. Rachel is next from Mount Hope. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Thank you. I'm calling because I happen to agree with an earlier caller named Rodney. I think that too much money goes directly to the insurance company and not enough benefits go to the people who are paying the insurance premiums. In my particular situation, I am a mother with two little children, and I got a notice from Blue Cross Blue Shield Anthem saying that my insurance would go up to over $980 this September. My little children and I, their immunizations are not covered. Oftentimes, their doctor's visits, well baby checks, are not covered. I recently had my annual physical, which is just preventative, the mammogram and everything else, and none of that was covered. I had to pay over $800 out of pocket. Meanwhile, my insurance agent lives in a mansion with an in-ground, indoor swimming pool, an indoor full-court basketball.
Oh, my gosh.
And here I am struggling to make ends meet as a full-time student. And it just seems very strange to me, but I don't think that anything will ever improve because the insurance companies have all the money, so they're the ones that are paying all the politicians to make all the decisions. And the decisions that are being made are not in the favor of your individual person who's paying out these enormous premiums.
John?
I think, you know, you raise an important issue, and I think it's important to separate two different parties here. There's the insurance companies and the insurance agents, and you mentioned both. In terms of the insurance companies, you know, the truth is, it's not. I think you're exactly right. It's not really worth discussing their role in some sense because they're always going to be with us. It's a $500 billion industry. It's not going away. And I think that whether or not, you know, I think that the best thing we can do there is set up a competitive environment so insurance companies compete with each other to get your prices down and to not make excessive profits. On terms of insurance agents and your guy with the indoor basketball court, that's another issue. Insurance agents are really, I think, in many ways, an unnecessary evil in our society at this point. Given the web, given the ease of shopping, there's really no reason why we should have to pay someone 4 or 5% of insurance premiums to find an insurance plan for us. In Massachusetts, we've set something up, our connector, which you can check out at www.mahealthconnector.org. is a very convenient portal where you can shop. You don't need to use an agent. And I think my sense is agents may be something, we actually are cutting out of the system, even if the insurance companies are still with us.
Thanks for the call. Here's an interesting issue, too. If I have a specialist doctor, one year the doctor might be in the network, and the next year this person isn't. As a result, I'm paying beyond what I'm already paying for insurance, or I have to develop a new relationship with a new doctor who is in the network. How does Massachusetts deal with this issue?
I mean, network is a major issue. A large way you get costs down is by having a restrictive network. And what that means is that sometimes doctors you want to see will not be in the network. I think the best way to deal with that issue is to say, look, the state is going to subsidize a package or have a minimum package that has a pretty restrictive network. And then if people want to pay more to see doctors of their choice, you know, God bless them, let them do it. But people should have to do that out of their own pocket, not out of state subsidies.
We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation as we look at Massachusetts healthcare reform. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Bill from DeForest is next. Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Oh, life is good.
Good.
My issue is what is the end point for a therapy? And why I'm asking this question is I know Medicare is just incredibly expensive to sustain. But I've been noticing a woman in our neighborhood who, for the last several years at least, I don't know her very well, but she's about 70, quite obese, and every day a van comes and picks her up and takes her away from 9 till about 5 o'clock, and there's nursing care there on the weekend for this woman. And it's been going on for quite some time, and one thing I do notice is that she has oxygen in her nose. She's riding on a scooter that she takes out to her porch, and then she's out there smoking cigarettes.
Oh.
And I'm just wondering, at what point do we just simply say enough is enough and this cost is just over our head?
You know, that's a great and very hard question. You know, in England, you cannot get a transplant if you're over a certain age. And you cannot get a transplant unless you're willing to sign a document which says you'll no longer smoke and or drink in some cases. And that is a very un-American way of thinking about things. But in fact, you have to ask yourself, at what point do we want to continue to have a healthcare system that devotes a lot of its resources to people who aren't behaving responsibly personally? I remember there's this great article in the New York Times a couple years ago about a West Virginia program which was going to penalize people for not behaving in a healthy way. And there's a guy in the front page of the New York Times with his oxygen in one hand and his cigarette in the other saying, they're not taking away my damn cigarette. And, you know, that's at some point the question is society willing to stand up to that and say, well, look, we are taking away your damn cigarette or we're not paying for your health insurance anymore.
Don't sell them anymore. Maybe that's an answer, right?
Well, I you know, it's another topic, but I certainly think that we certainly need to be tougher on smoking.
Thanks very much for the call, Bill. Let's go next to Steve from Waupaca. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think our biggest problem in this country is that we have a third party getting rich off of people's illness, which is just immorally wrong. We don't have a third party getting rich off of our fire departments and our need for fire suppression. We don't have a third party getting rich off of our police protection in this country, which are fundamental rights to be protected, you know, from criminals and things. Why do we have a third party getting rich off of our health care? It's just so immorally wrong that somebody sitting in an office is deciding whether you get health care or not, depending on whether it's profitable for a third party. It's ridiculous. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
I mean, I think, you know, that is the fundamental issue that's at the center of a lot of national debates, which is, you know, should private insurance have a role? I have two answers to that. One is it's sort of not worth debating because they are going to have a role in a real politics sense. But I think stepping back, you know, to, you know, philosophically, should they have a role? You know, it's not quite as easy as the caller painted it. You know, for example, we talked about our fire department doesn't have a middleman. Well, you know, here in Massachusetts, we have a problem because we're paying our retired policemen hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in unregulated pensions that they're getting because the legislature's afraid to take on the policemen's union. Now, it's not entirely clear. Yes, there's not a third party involved. It's just the government. But this is the government. It's a situation where the government's vastly overpaying individuals for their prior service. So I think it's not quite as cut and dry to say it's right if the government does it, it's wrong if the private sector does it.
As we talk, John, I'm wondering what it is that's different about the makeup of the population in the state of Massachusetts. John earlier was talking about the fact that Democrats, Republicans, virtually everybody in your state thought that this was a moral issue, particularly when it comes to the uninsured, that something had to be done about that. It was universally agreed that this was a substantial concern. And so whatever your political persuasion, people gathered to do something about it. Is there something different about the rest of the country? Don't we have the same moral concern here?
I think fundamentally there are differences across the country. I think on this aspect, Wisconsin's not so different from Massachusetts. I think a place like Texas might be. But I think in this dimension, Wisconsin's not. I think it's more an issue of we have a history of a very, since the health sector is such an important part of our economy here in Massachusetts, we have a history of a lot of interactions between policymakers and the health sector and such that made it easier. But in terms of what's required, which is really a progressive attitude and a notion that the government's here to make lives better for its citizens, I think Wisconsin exactly meets that criterion, historically at least as well as Massachusetts.
Let's agree. Steve, let's thank you for your call and go to Rebecca from Warren. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I just had a comment about, as I understood it earlier, the law that makes people, whether it's young people or whatever, that can afford or have the money to pay for insurance, that I guess it makes them pay for that. I am 19, and I work for a small business, and I pay for the big majority of my own insurance. And I guess I kind of have a problem with the idea that the government can make people pay for something that they don't want. I know, you know, there's a lot of issues and financial issues, but I guess I just think it's kind of outside the government's jurisdiction to make them pay for something like that.
Well, I think, you know, this is the coming at the heart of the Massachusetts approach and basically the individual mandate. And I guess I have a couple of responses. First of all, the government makes you do lots of things in life. It makes you get a driver's license. It makes you pay your taxes. These are things which probably none of us would like to do if the government didn't make us do them. So it's not an issue that the government, that this is the first time the government's going to tell people what to do. I think it really comes back to what I was mentioning earlier, which is the only way we make health reform work is to get everyone in the game. If we continue with our current system where healthy people could stay out and just say, well, if I get hit by a car, I'll go to the emergency room, or if I get pregnant, I'll just buy health insurance then, that's a system which is going to continue to discriminate and be unfair to the sick. And basically, we need to pool together as a society and pool our resources, because at the end of the day, we're all going to get sick at some point. It's, you know, you're 19 now and a student and healthy, and that's great, but at some point you may want to have a child, or at some point you may get ill, and at some point you're going to want that health insurance. And it's sort of unfair that you could avoid having it now and leaving the cost high for other people, but then when you need it, the cost will be high for you. It's better to just sort of pool society together.
Thanks, Rebecca. Corrine is next from Brookfield. Hi, Corrine.
Hi, I'm actually an insurance agent, and I took a little offense to being called a necessary evil. I personally have a difficult time selling health insurance because I think the real issue is the concept of the way that individual health insurance is so non-consumer friendly, if you will. And I think the biggest issue I see with my clients is, you know, people who have worked their whole life, who are retirees and or, you know, maybe have had the opportunity to retire early, who have diagnoses that cause them to be declined. And as an insurance agent, I think I help them navigate that, I guess, field and figure out what their solutions are, and then with people who aren't unhealthy and who can get the insurance as a middleman, if you will, I think I help them figure out what the best contracts are for them. And so I do think that there are insurance agents whose motivations are wrong, I would say, and who are motivated by money. But there are a lot of insurance agents who really, I think, provide a necessary service.
So first of all, in terms of sort of what motivates insurance agents, I did not mean to impugn the profession as a motivation. I think most insurance agents are trying to match their clients with the best service. What I meant about being unnecessary is basically, you know, that in a world of universal health coverage with sensible shopping frameworks, it would all be clear enough on the web that, you know, unfortunately for you, your services would no longer be necessary. The notion would be there'd be a circumscribed set of health insurance packages that are very clearly laid out. And that people could shop pretty effectively. Now, I'm not saying that some people with the money wouldn't want to then avail themselves of an agent to help them navigate that, but the issue should be that people who don't have the money, who don't want to use an agent, shouldn't have to, that it should be clear enough so that if I don't want to use an agent, I can go ahead and just do it on my own.
John, thank you so much for being with us. It was a great hour. We learned a lot. John Gruber, this half hour, professor of economics at MIT and director of the program on children at the National Bureau of Economic Research. We also thank John Kingsdale. Rob Schroeder, our producer of this program. Thanks, Rob. It was good to look at this state. Rest assured, we will continue doing many more programs on health insurance. It is something that many of us care about. All of us care about. Thanks to Rob as well for on-air production. We have news coming up and then Nancy Pearl. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network.